Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's the Board Game Brothers podcast. My name is Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming, all things gaming. This is our podcast. Welcome to the podcast, everybody, for another beautiful day and another beautiful episode.
In a beautiful house.
Yes. And today we are talking about, well, today, this month of May, we've decided to make our greatest hits.
Greatest hits is a bit of a misnomer. It's more of our best ofs, our favorite things.
Wait, how is that not greatest hits?
That's usually stuff you've already done, you know? Like,
Okay, well, it's not greatest hits episodes, it's greatest hits games.
Right.
Which is what we're talking about. So today we're talking about one of our favorite games. We've mentioned it a number of times on the podcast, and we figured, you know, we keep mentioning it, we might as well do an episode to let you all in on what it's about so that you can follow along with our reasoning on the other episodes where we've mentioned it. It's one of our favorite games, personally, all time. It's a really great game, and that game is... Scythe,
designed by Jamie Stegmaier, who I've mentioned a number of times, I know for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Published by Stonemaier Games in 2016, which is actually local to St. Louis, fun fact. And it won, among a number of awards, the Golden Geek Award for Best Artwork, Best Strategy Game, Best Solo Game, and Game of the Year to top it all off in 2016.
Mm-hmm. And it was published in 2016, right?
Yeah, this game was pretty big when it came out, and even before it came out, it was making waves.
Yep. So, just to tell you guys a little bit about what Scythe is all about, here's a short description. In Scythe, players control factions attempting to establish a hold on a contested, war-torn country. Starting with just a leader and a handful of workers, players take turns producing and trading for resources, which they spend on strengthening their troops, gaining popularity with the locals, recruiting locals for your own faction, or building powerful mechs in order to mobilize units and wage war against your opponents. There are 10 objectives in the game centered around the player's actions, and after a player has completed 6 of these objectives, the game is over and points are scored. Players earn points from the number of objectives they have completed, from the number of territory spaces they occupy, from the number of points from the number of pairs of resources they have, and from how much money they have acquired throughout the game. And that's just the shortest description I could manage for this game, because it's a pretty complicated game, and there's a lot of parts to it that all connect with each other.
Yeah. It's like an ecosystem of mechanics.
Right. So you're trying to do all these things to establish power. You could call this one of the a 4X game, which, Matthew, what are the 4Xs of a 4X game?
You're putting me on the spot here. All right. It is explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate.
So there's really, I guess, not much of an explore part to this game, but for the most part, yes, this is a 4X game. And like we said, it's got a lot of these intricate small parts that all add together in order for you as a player to lead your faction to victory. So as we get into the gameplay and the strategy involved in the gameplay, I think before we do that, we should talk about the player mat and the faction. So each player at the beginning of the game starts with a faction, which is represented by a color of pieces and a leader. And then you also start with a player mat, which is the whole thing that your actions on your turn are centered around. So on a player's turn, they perform one of four, we'll call them actions, but there's multiple parts to each action. On a player mat, they have the four actions that go across the top that are the same for every four players. They do the exact same things for every four players, depending on which action you choose to play. And then along the bottom of the player mat, lined up with each of the four actions, there is a chance for a player to spend a type of resource to perform a bonus action. which usually involves constructing something or upgrading something. So to go into detail, let's just trade off. Let's say we'll start with the top four, and we'll describe what they do, and we'll just start, and then we'll move on to the bottom four, and we'll just switch off. So right. Matthew, if you'd like to start.
It should be noted real quick that each player mat has these in a different combination of tops and bottoms.
Right. I was going to say that, yeah, the tops, I'll just say that the tops, they're exactly the same for all players. They do the same thing. They start with the same things covered up and organized in a certain way, which you'll understand as we get into the description. It's really the bottom parts that are shuffled around. And they also have different resource costs to them.
Right.
So let's start with the top.
Right. So on this specific one, so the first action that you'll find is the pay to bolster, which you take the action, you pay one coin, one money, whatever, and then you bolster, which means you can either get war power, which directly is just a flat resource you can spend in war, or you can get a combat card, which has a variable power on it, which can range from 2 to 5, with different numbers of each card in the deck. Mm-hmm. And the sort of key difference, just to really briefly explain, is that you can bluff and hide what your combat cards say, but your opponents will always know what your war power is.
Mm-hmm. And war power is tracked on a sliding scale
right.
on the board by moving a piece up and down it. And so whenever, of course, you gain it, you move your piece up.
War power does lead to one of the star achievements that can end
right.
the game.
We'll talk about those right after we're done right. with this. The second action you can take is you can pay, and the cost of payment changes as the game goes on, to produce. Which this is kind of your producing from territories, your farming, if you will. You choose a number of hexagonal tiles that you control workers on, territory tiles that you have workers on. And then for each worker on the tile that you choose, you produce one resource that comes from that tile. And just so you know, the four resources in the game are food, or I guess five resources. They are food, wood, iron, oil, and more workers.
Yeah.
And as you produce more workers, there's a limit to however many you can place on the board. And they sit on a part of the board that covers up the payment for this space. So as you produce more workers with this action, the production cost gets higher. So it starts out free, and then it increases to include involving war power, popularity, and eventually money.
Yeah. So then there is the move/gain action. When you take this action, you can move your units a number of spaces based on, I think it starts as 2 each time.
Mm-hmm. No, it's 1. You move 1 unit 1 space.
1 unit 1 space icon. Per symbol.
And you can do that twice.
Right. Or instead of moving, you can get a coin.
Mm-hmm. And then the last action is you pay 1 coin to either gain 2 of any resource from the supply, or you can gain 1 popularity. And the popularity tracker is another sliding scale, just like the war tracker that goes up and down. And this is a good way to get resources that you don't have access to with your production action, which we'll go into later. So those are the four primary actions. To go over them real quick again, the first one is pay a gold and either gain war power or gain secret war power cards. The second one is to pay a variable cost in order to produce resources from your territories. The third one is to move your troops. And the fourth one is to pay to get resources from the bank or get popularity. So now let's talk about the bottom actions.
Right.
So these typically, they all involve spending one particular kind of resource to do one specific kind of action. And they line up with different top actions for every player board, and they have different costs for every player board. So Matthew, let's go over them.
So the first one is pay oil to upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so this is the first sort of instance where we talk, or The second instance we talk about wooden objects covering up parts of your your player mat.
Because as we mentioned, the workers cover up the cost for production.
Right. And this is something that like the entire player mat uses.
Mm-hmm.
With upgrades, there are cubes that are covering parts of the top row of actions.
Because they use little tiny square icons to notate what you're doing with each action. And the cubes are covering some of them up, making your actions less effective.
Right. And when you upgrade, you take one of those cubes and move it to an open space where those cubes could go on the bottom. So, and those open spaces are where the cost for these actions on the bottom.
Right. So we exist. Mentioned that upgrading costs oil. On this mat we're looking at, there's three oil icons. So that means you have to trade three oil resources in order to perform the upgrade action. And but the third oil icon is a little inset on the board. So if you were to use the upgrade action to remove a cube from the top, which could, for example, it could let you move an additional piece each turn with the move action, then you can slot it into that resource cost slot for the upgrade action, therefore making it cost only two oil to use rather than three.
Right.
The second action on this board that we can see is deploying mechs. This costs iron, it lets you deploy one of your four mechs from your faction card. You start with none of them on the board, and you want to make them because they are, other than your character, which is the special unit that is like the leader of your faction that you start with on the board, the only units you can use to wage war against opponents are the mechs. Your mechs can also carry your workers around. So they're very good for mobility, they're very good for waging war, and after you build a mech, you unlock an upgrade for all of your mechs and characters that make them more effective at moving around and fighting. To talk about these upgrades really quick, each faction has four unique upgrades for their mechs. And you start with the mechs covering them up. This is another example, kind of like the upgrade action that we just described, where a piece serves two functions based on where it sits at the beginning of the game and what you do with it after you use it. So for upgrades, it covers up an action, and you can move it to uncover that action, make it better, and also reduce the cost. With mechs, they cover up upgrades for your mechs. So when you create a mech, you remove it from your faction, you place it on the board, it now functions as a mech that can move around, carry troops, and fight people, and it also uncovers the upgrade for all of your mechs and your character. And most all the factions have an upgrade that lets them cross rivers on the map, because the map has rivers that serve as boundaries for certain territories.
Specifically letting them cross rivers between two types of territories. Mm-hmm.
And then they also have other mobility options and other battle options that make them more effective in combat.
And then they always have plus one speed,
mm-hmm.
which lets your movement sort of icons,
yeah.
when you take the move action,
lets you move one extra space. So rather than just moving one unit one space, if it's a mech, you move it two spaces.
Yeah.
And then you can move something else as well. So that is the mechs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second thing you can spend resources on, and you spend iron on that, to reiterate. Right.
The third thing is pay wood to build a structure or mm-hmm. a building. It just says build.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are four buildings, one for each top action.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they cover up part of something on that action space, but these are unique actions, sort of, that you can only get when you build the building.
Right, because they're covered up at the beginning of the game.
Right.
So you need to build the building in order to gain access to them.
For bolster, if you build the monument from the bolster action, whenever you take the bolster action, you can gain a popularity.
Mm-hmm.
For produce, you can build the mill, which when you take the produce action, you get one resource of the tile the mill is on, as if it was a worker that's just permanently there.
Mm-hmm.
For the move and gain, you get the mine, which there are a number of tunnel spaces.
There's six tunnel spaces on the board.
Right, and they're represented by red outlines on certain spaces with a little tunnel icon. The mine lets you move troops and units from your tunnel to one of the, or from your mine to one of the tunnels, or vice versa, or between tunnels.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can go between tunnels without the mine.
Okay, but with it, you can go from your mine to tunnels and vice versa.
And only you can use it.
Yes. And that is a separate thing from your move as well. And then also, there is, for the pay and trade, you can build the armory, which gives you one war power whenever you use that action.
Mm-hmm.
So, these are all pretty different buildings that pretty much just give a more substantial upgrade to mm-hmm. one of the top actions.
And when you build them, you place them on the board. In the case of the mill, it's important where you place it because it produces the resource from the space that you put it on.
Right, and the mine's also important.
Because you want to put it in a place where your troops can access it easily so that they can access the tunnels easier.
The armory and monument don't do anything necessarily to the place they're on, but it can impact the game in other ways.
Yes, plus you can only have one structure on one tile, so you can't put them all on the same tile.
Right, and to be clear, every of the main factions starts on a island, sort of, with three spaces, so you can't build all four on your starting island.
Right. So that's the building. And then the last resource action you can take at the bottom of the player mat is called enlisting. So each of these bottom actions that we've described, upgrading, building a mech, and building a house, as well as enlisting, they have an additional final resource thing in the corner. It's a circle, and it's covered up by a cylindrical piece. When you enlist, you take one of those cylindrical pieces, you move it to the top to your faction board, not to the top of the player map, but to the faction board. Doing so gives you a temporary or a one-time bonus of one kind of resource, which can be war power money, war power cards, popularity. It's a one-time boost of that, but in addition, anytime you or one of your neighbors performs the action that you enlisted from. So, for example, if you move the cylinder that was on the enlist space, you get one of those four bonuses that I just mentioned. But also, anytime you or someone else next to you, to your left or right, uses the enlist action, then you will gain a war card. And then other resources are gained from the other actions. Every time you or somebody next to you builds a structure, you can get a popularity. Anytime you or someone next to you gives or deploys a mech, you get a gold. And then for upgrade, it's war power. And this is the same for everybody, what the enlists line up to. And this is kind of a way, this is how you spend your food, and it's kind of a way to capitalize on your opponent's actions, the ones that are next to you. It gives you resources when it's not your turn, which is pretty important. And I think the flavor behind it is you're kind of working with the people in the nation, the locals of the nation that you're invading.
Yeah.
And they're sort of helping you out. They're giving you little benefits every time you do something
they're
there.
Smuggling
every time
new
your
cards.
Neighbors do something. Sure. And those are the four actions. So just to reiterate what those four actions are again, upgrade, it makes the actions on top better and it makes the actions on bottom cheaper. That's upgrade. That costs oil. Iron is mechs. So it lets you deploy a mech as well as unlock an upgrade for all your mechs and your character. Building structures, you spend wood, you choose one of these four structures that just unlock an additional part to the top action, and may serve some other kind of function on the board. And then the enlist is something that allows you to get bonus resources from the bottom actions whenever you or the people to your left and right complete them.
And that one costs food.
Yes. In addition to all of this, all these actions on the bottom will provide you with an amount of gold every time you complete them. And this is different for every player. For the example we're looking at right now, enlist does not provide you with any gold. The house will give you one gold every time you build a structure. The mech will give you two gold, and the upgrade will give you three gold. So, now that all of that is out of the way, and it is now 20 minutes into the podcast, we can talk about the strategy.
Oh, yeah.
So you start with two workers. I'm going to just... We can try and make this brief. I've tried to sort of segment this into early game, mid game, late game actions.
Right.
Because... Oh, and we didn't even talk about the objectives. We should mention those briefly. So there's 10 objectives, mm-hmm. and you need to complete 6 in order to end the game. And those 10 objectives are build all your structures, build all your mechs, make all your upgrades, enlist all the recruits,
get all your workers,
create all your workers, complete a hidden objective, which you start with 2 hidden objectives and you can only complete 1, defeat 1 opponent in war,
twice,
defeat another
yeah.
person in war, it can be the same opponent, just win another war, and then raise your popularity tracker all the way to the end, or raise your war tracker all the way to the end. Those are the 10 objectives. So really the strategy, since this is how you end the game, and this is also kind of how you get the most points in the game, your strategy involves picking 6 of those as soon as you can and focusing on completing those as fast as you can while keeping your popularity high.
Right.
Because at the end of the game, you get a number of points for each objective you've completed, as well as territory you control, like I mentioned before, resources you have, money you have. But how many points you get for each of these things is determined by your popularity. So there's sort of 3 tiers to it. The bottom tier is the lowest amount of points. That's from 0 popularity to 6 popularity. And it goes all the way up to the maximum popularity, which is basically 3 times more points per each of these things. So you want to try and reach a high number of popularity so you're getting more points per each of these things that you can do. And the objectives give you the most points. So strategy-wise, you want to complete the objectives, you want to complete them faster than other people, and you want to have high enough popularity by the time right. you do so.
With all that in mind, you also want to try to get across the river and out of your island as soon as possible?
Well, so yeah, so now we're talking about early game.
Oh, right, yeah.
Sorry. So the overall strategy objectives.
Yeah.
Early game strategy, you want to build a mech or find a way to leave your starting territories, because you only start with 3 territories, and if you remember, there's 5 different resources that you can collect from spaces, so you won't have access to all of them, and you need to, because even though you might want to just focus on building mechs and doing upgrades, you're probably still going to eventually be able to do an enlist and also build some structures along the way, so it's not a bad thing to diversify your strategy a little bit at certain points of the game, just to have some access to other things.
Especially because building structures and enlisting both give you popularity for basically free,
mm-hmm.
which, as we mentioned, is also very important throughout the game.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want to be able to leave your territory. So that either means building your mine, which lets you move to the tunnels in the center of the map, or it means building a mech, which gives you the ability to transport units across rivers, which each of your starting areas is bordered by rivers. So that's how you get out.
This is also important because the factory in the center, mm-hmm. which is a space in the center of the board, it counts as 3 tiles for the purpose of scoring at the end of the game, if you control it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the first time you get there, you get a extra action, which is like a card that you put next to your player mm-hmm. board. It's another thing you can do, usually more powerful than what's on your board. But there's 1 copy of each one,
mm-hmm.
so that's a first-come, first-served
thing. So now we're talking about mid-game.
Well, hold on.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, the other reason you want to get off your island is there are encounters, which are sort of like choose-your-own-adventure quests. You go on a space, and if there is an encounter token there...
Well, if your character goes on a space.
Right, if your character goes on a space with this token that you set up at the start of the game, then you take the token off, you read a card, and it gives you a couple options that give you different resources and bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
Those are both really important things that you want to try to get to soon.
Right. So early game, you want to probably produce at least 1 more worker, because you can do so without having to increase the cost of production.
Yeah.
You want to move your character to the encounter space within your starting area, which everyone starts with 1 encounter nearby. And the encounters give you pretty big bonuses to resources It's sort of like this cool choose-your-own-adventure kind of scenario.
That's what I just said.
And then you also want to build your mech or find a way to move outside. This is the early game. Yeah. Mid-game, you want to get, I would say, at least 4 more workers. That makes it cost war power and popularity. If you don't want it to cost popularity, you want to get just 2 more workers, but 2 to 4 more workers. You want to upgrade at least your production space, which lets you choose 1 additional space to produce from, and your movement space, which lets you move 1 additional piece. These are the 2 most important upgrades in the game, just because they give you such a much, much larger bonus than the other 2, which are only important if you are planning on your tracker for war power or your tracker for popularity being your end goal objectives.
Or if you need to get to the highest tier of popularity and the game seems like it's going to end soon.
Right. But otherwise, the production and movement are the most important upgrades. So that's mid-game. You also want to build more mechs, mobilize your mechs and your workers, get more encounters across the board, and then eventually hit the factory.
Yeah.
For that, for what you mentioned was the extra 5th action, which is typically like it lets you pay a hefty price of resources in order to do something like just straight up gain an upgrade or build a mech or something like that.
Right.
So then you're into the end game. After you've become a more worldly presence, you have pieces all around the board, you've picked up all the encounters are gone, so you can't hit those to get special big bonuses. You've been to the factory. And you're starting to see that your goals are coming to an end. So basically the end game is just plan the fastest strategy to get to your 6 objectives and try to be standing on the factory at the end of the game.
Right. Or try to spread out your workers if you're in a safe position,
mm-hmm.
because that just gives you more points for more spaces anyways.
Right.
It is really important to note that since you can get 2 stars from winning fights, it could be worth it late game to try to just pick fights.
Sure.
Because that ends the game much sooner for you if you're in a winning position.
So when we say pick the 6 objectives you want to complete to win the game, it could be more like pick 4 objectives.
Right.
And then along the way, or eventually just beat 2 people in combat.
If you don't want to fight, then it's important to be able to use your bottom action every single turn.
Mm-hmm.
So you always want to be building something or upgrading something, doing something, because those do lead to victories.
Right.
And I do want to mention, throughout the entire game, it is very important to know what your faction is good at. Because mm-hmm. each faction also has a special ability on the top right corner that they start the game with.
Mm-hmm.
And these can heavily impact your playstyle.
I think they can. I think that they don't really determine how you're going to win, but they do make certain actions better than others.
Right.
Meaning that they could make one objective a little more favorable than the others.
Right.
But they wouldn't determine all 6 of your objectives.
They don't determine objectives, they determine playstyle.
Right.
So like, for example, the white one, Anna and Wojak, they get the ability to pick up 2 options per encounter card that they get. So they're good at getting encounters. Not to mention, they have the submerge ability for their mechs, which lets them and their mechs move to and from any lake.
As if it were like a mine.
And to move into a lake.
Yeah.
So they're very good at moving around the board to get all these encounters early game.
Mm-hmm. There's a blue faction whose ability is that their workers can move across rivers. So this is the only faction that's not entirely constrained to their starting area at the beginning of the game. They can have access to all 5 resources through their workers to start with, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
There's the... Well, we'll save that for last. There's the yellow faction, which once per turn can spend combat cards as if they were resource tokens. So this is a good faction for collecting a lot of combat cards, getting into a lot of fights, and then the turns where they would collect the combat cards aren't wasted for the purposes of producing, because technically they're also gaining resources at the same time.
They also have a mech ability that lets them steal a combat card mm-hmm. from an opponent they fight.
Yes.
The black one, they can move between mountains, which are the iron spaces and any tunnel. So
that's one of their mech upgrades.
That's one of their mech upgrades. Their faction ability is there is no limit to the number of stars they can place from completing objectives and winning combat.
So this is one of the only ones where the victory is a little more solidified from their faction card, because it says they can normally you can only get two victories or two objectives from war and one objective from secret objectives,
right,
which involve like maintaining certain territories, controlling certain territories,
having certain resources,
yeah, having certain counts of resources, stuff like that,
right. And they also, it says before combat, oh, this is another mech ability, that their opponents get weaker when they fight on tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very good at just picking fights in the middle of the board.
Yeah, and they, again, they can get all six of their objectives from just winning wars, so they're pretty good at that. And then the final one is the red faction, and their ability is something that we haven't mentioned yet, which is normally we mention these four actions. You can't do the same action twice in the row unless you're the red faction. Otherwise, if you perform, say, the move action, then the next turn you can't do that. You have to go and do the production, the bolster, or the trade for resources.
Right.
And then the turn after that, you can go back and move if you want to move further on the board.
They also have a mech ability that lets them move from villages, which are the red worker spaces that let you get workers, to and from the factory.
Yes. So they can just leap across the board like that.
Straight to the factory.
Mm-hmm. So these are the factions, and your strategy, the kind of objectives that you're going to be gunning for in the game are really all centered around what your faction is, but more importantly, what your player mat is.
Right.
Because your player mat, because it gives you different amounts of gold and it can cost different amounts of resources for those bottom objectives, it might make one of those, I'll call them collect them all objectives, where it's essentially, you know, making all your mechs, doing all your enlists, making all your upgrades, getting all your workers, whatever. It makes some better than others, depending on what your player mat says at the top and at the bottom, or at the bottom only. Let's see. So just to go into a little more detail on these 10 objectives, I have categorized them based on which are the fastest to obtain, as in you can complete them in just one or two turns. Which are the easiest to obtain, because you can either do them from the beginning or you can do them without very much interaction between other players, and which are not the fastest and not the easiest, but the most useful. So the fastest objectives are creating all your workers, because since when you produce one resource for each worker on a tile, if you just dump all your workers onto a tile that produces more workers, it's exponential.
It takes 2 turns.
It takes 2 turns. It takes 1 turn of production. You go from 2 to 4. The next turn, you go from 4 to 8. Now you have all your workers. So that can be done in 2 turns, but you don't want to do that soon, obviously. You want to do that later in the game as one of those last-minute objectives. And then beating people in war only takes 1 turn, because all it takes is moving a mech onto a space that another opponent's mech occupies, and then wagering your war cards and your war tracker numbers in order to beat them with a higher number. The easiest objectives are your secret objective, the popularity tracker, and the war tracker, because these three are uninteractive. Your opponent can't stop you from doing them. You just slowly gain more and more and more as the game progresses, and eventually you're just going to get them, and nobody can stop you from doing that, making them the easiest. The last few, they require resources to complete, and resources can be taken from you if an opponent steals the territory that you're on that has all the resources in it. You keep resources on the board, so they're not like in your pockets or anything, and somebody, if they take the territory away from you, the resources stay there.
Of course, you can carry resources when your workers or units move.
Right, but that would spend a turn transporting resources to more safer territories, so I guess that kind of sets you back a little tempo wise
unless you already are moving,
right? But so it's not it's slightly interactive how you can complete these objectives. But these are basically just the collect them all objectives. They're not fast and they're not easy, but they're the most useful because as you complete them, you get better and better. As you complete upgrades, your turns become more efficient. As you complete mechs, your mechs become stronger. You can move further in a single turn. As you complete structures, you get small incremental bonuses that add up as the game progresses. Same with enlists. As you enlist recruits, you get these small bonuses that add up throughout the course of the game.
I would honestly say mechs are the most useful of those four, specifically because they also let you easier fight and, you know,
they give you more options
for spreading troops around. Everything else, basically.
Yes, mechs are certainly the most important. And then after that, it depends, because enlists are better early game. But depending on your strategy, they might be useless. Like, if you don't care about the kind of resources that enlists are providing you, then they're not super important. They're helpful. The structures are probably the least important, except for the mine, I would say.
I think the structures are important if you can start on an island with wood.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they're not super necessary.
And then the upgrades are pretty important because they make your actions slightly better.
Oh, yeah.
Including the action that lets you upgrade.
Yeah.
So they kind of cascade into faster and faster upgrades, as well as faster production of other bottom actions.
It gets you closer to that point where you can do an upgrade or something every turn as well.
It can also make something cost just one resource to perform. So, like, in the example of the mat that we have in front of us, the mech starts out costing 3 iron, but after 2 upgrades, it only costs 1 iron, which is pretty crazy, just building a mech for 1 iron. And so that can cascade into faster other objective completions. And again, the goal of the game is just to complete as many objectives as you can to get the most points. There's one thing that we haven't talked about yet, and that's just a side bonus that you can go for. That's called the structure placement objectives. Essentially, there's a handful of cards. You pick one of them at the beginning of the game, and it gives you bonus points at the end of the game based on where you have placed your structures. So they usually involve like placing them on certain resources or near lakes or near rivers and stuff like that. So it could be important to keep that in mind as you build your structures. You know, if you have the option of building between a space that won't give you any points for this and a space that will give you points for this, obviously pick the space that will give you points. It's not many points unless you're able to complete all 4 of your structures in places that will give you points from this secret objective. But you know, every little bit can help at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that is strategy. Can we think of anything else we need to talk about for strategy?
One important thing to note about combat.
Mm-hmm.
So just sort of passing by how combat works, just brief description, you wager cards and power, and then you reveal in attacker wins ties, otherwise whoever has the higher power wins. If the attacker takes over a space through combat that has workers on it, the workers retreat back to their owner's home
along with any other pieces. Well, yeah. So like the mechs and the character,
right. But the attacker loses 1 popularity per worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true if they just go to a space that has workers but no mech. So that's sort of an interesting thing to note, is with popularity really affecting how many points you can get. You can sometimes use workers defensively by spreading them out or by carrying them with your mech to dissuade people from attacking.
Right.
Or if you are attacking, it's important to remember that popularity loss.
Right, but,
and plan accordingly.
But just so you know, you can't sacrifice your own workers by starting a fight holding the workers in the mech.
Right.
You don't lose, or your opponents don't lose popularity from removing workers if they're defending.
Right. Only attackers.
Yeah, only attackers can lose popularity from displacing workers back to the player's starting points.
Otherwise, that'd be super scummy.
Yes.
All right.
Right. Okay, so
hefty game.
Hefty game. It's a lot of things, and if you're paying attention, you notice that a lot of them will move into one another.
Oh, yeah.
like, you know, we say the enlists provide you with small incremental bonuses. Like you can get popularity from enlists, which then in turn increases your popularity tracker. Or you can get war power from building structures, which then makes you better at fighting in combat. And also yeah, it progresses your war power meter.
It's a dense ecosystem of a game. Uh-huh. It's like something Radiolab would cover.
And that's one of the most interesting parts about how this game was designed.
Right. Going straight into design.
Right. Is that it has a lot of small, simple, interconnected parts.
This is a phrase that designers like to use called elegance. Elegant design. Now, I don't know if there is, like, an agreed-upon definition.
I think it's fine, whatever you say.
So I put it as, elegant design is when the design combines logical design, intuitive design, resourceful design, and most of the time, simple design. Mm-hmm. So in this case, yeah, each piece, each component, each space, each upgrade,
each action,
it does triple duty.
Yes.
It exists, it does something when uncovered or covered, it allows you to do things, it flows together visually.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much that just interlocks together.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this comes from the construction of the player mat. Because what they've done is they've taken two pieces of cardboard. One of them has these indents die cut into them, and they glued them together so that there's these slots where you start with wooden pieces covering them up, and there's slots where you can move them to.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's brilliant, and it helps for setup. It keeps everything nice and neat in an orderly fashion.
Yeah,
and
if you slightly bump the table, it doesn't ruin it.
Right, and it's especially useful for the small cubes that cover up the upgrades.
And it feels good.
Yeah, and it's really neat.
It's just tactile, feels good.
It's pretty easy to see, like, you can move one thing to another thing, and what does that change?
Mm-hmm. And it also helps with, like, the structures. Mm-hmm. Each of those are a unique shape that fits into its own space.
Right.
Like, the armory is an octagon.
Yeah.
Amazing shape. Or, like, how the mechs, they cover up these circles that just have enough room to hide their
right.
ability.
Right. When they designed this game, they made sure that every piece involved, because, you know, when you look at this game, it's probably a lot of the cost of production goes into these pieces. They have individually shaped woodcut pieces for the mine, the monument, the mill, the armory, the upgrade cubes, the piece that goes on your war tracker, the piece that goes on the popularity tracker, your objective stars, your worker pieces, and then they also have plastic molded mechs and character pieces that are very detailed. So a lot of money to produce this game went into producing these unique pieces. Even the workers are different for each faction.
Yeah.
They have different hats. So this all increases cost, and individually shaped resource pieces. They're not just cubes. The food looks like food, the wood looks like wood, etc. So with all that in mind, they had to make these things do triple duty, or else they would have had to produce twice as many different kinds of pieces. Because one piece can do three different things, a mech can both serve as a mech on the board as well as cover up the mech's upgrades, I'm saying.
Also, it took us 35 or so minutes to, you know, explain the rules to the length we did.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have these pieces do a lot of things to make sure there wasn't way too many components, not just for price, but for comprehension.
Yeah.
And to keep it from being too overwhelming.
As complicated as the game is, it could have been way more complicated.
Oh, yeah.
It's honestly quite simple when you actually sit down and play it and think about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, speaking of simplicity, you know, there's so many different things in this game, but a single individual turn in the game is pretty simple.
Oh, yeah.
Like a round around the table of each player doing one turn can take a minute. Because it's just like, I collect a resource, I move a piece, I move something on a slider, turns her over, and that's it. In a turn where nobody buys anything, and even when you buy something, you know, most of the thought just goes into like, which upgrade do I want on my mech, or which building do I want to build, and then where do I want to place it, and then it's done with.
Right, and I think part of that's because really, other than the first turn, you have three choices of actions,
mm-hmm.
and you aren't always going to choose, you know, most likely two of them. Like, if you're already on the move space, you're probably not always going to take the bolster space, so mm-hmm. that really just cuts your choices down to two.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does a good job of keeping that complexity in depth, but limiting the turn-by-turn choices, keeping the pacing straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I do want to say something great about the mechs. They feel so good when you build one.
Yeah.
And it makes sense for a game that's sort of about mechs, quote-unquote. Like, they do have, like, obviously they have a big part in the gameplay.
Yeah.
But theme-wise,
right,
it's a big deal.
The world that this game takes place in is kind of this, like, sci-fi, but it's also kind of...
It's like, dieselpunk.
Yeah, it's dieselpunk. It's like historical steampunk.
Yeah.
It's kind of the theme of this historical fantasy, historical sci-fi. So you can tell that the mechs are kind of this interesting thing from the artwork and from the pieces, because it's like all these tiny wooden pieces that represent workers and upgrades and stuff like that. But then the mechs are these intricate, large plastic molded pieces.
Yeah.
And they really stand out aside from your character, just how important they are compared to all the other resources you have as a player, all the pieces you have as a player.
Yeah. And the mechanics of the game and the size of the pieces, the weight that their upgrades give,
mm-hmm.
and sort of the importance they have throughout the game, it all really helps to add this feeling of scale and sort of wonder at the mechs.
Mm-hmm.
It really gives them an impact and an importance.
I mentioned the artwork right now, and we mentioned that this game won awards for its artwork.
Yeah.
Almost all the illustrations were done by Jacob Rosalski. And he, I imagine that he played a big role in the theme of this game, because I think this artist was doing this kind of artwork in this kind of fictional world before the game was conceived. This idea of this sort of like pastoral setting in farmlands, you know, in like the center of Russia or something. And then there's these giant mechs there too.
Looming in
the background. Sometimes they're like a broken remnant of a war that once was waged there. Other times they're sort of like mobile troops passing through.
Or they're like overseeing workers.
Yes. Yeah. And that appears in all the artwork. A lot of the times in the artwork, you'll see the mechs will be far in the distance. They'll be kind of grayed out from atmospheric perspective.
They'll have an upwards angle towards them if you're a cinematic person.
Or you mean the player's line height, sight height. Height of sight. What's the word I'm looking
line
for?
Line of sight.
Point of view. Perspective is low to the ground.
Right.
It's eye level with all the other humans in the scene, but the mechs obviously tower much higher than you are.
Yeah, I think in some of them it's not always eye level.
It's just about. And yeah, it's all very detailed, and the color palette is pretty muted.
Yeah,
but they give little pops of color whenever necessary. Little red bits and clothing details. The small lights shining from the shadowy mechs in the distance.
It's like this mix of like oddly bleak but yet calm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's very interesting.
It provides a good atmosphere. Oddly bleak but calm is kind of fitting for the way that the gameplay goes.
Oh yeah.
Because you can have the game goes on for quite a long time before any player interaction occurs, because you're on this island that you can't leave. And it takes a while to build a mech, and even after you build a mech, because you can only move every other turn, it takes a while for you to move across the board to a place where other people's pieces are left. So the encounters don't happen until much later in the game. It all feels pretty calm to start with.
And then sometimes it ends up like a Cold War where, like, you don't really want to actually engage combat, but it is sort of an arms race going on, a nervous tension.
Plus, no, I don't know how the game was kind of balanced or created this way, but it seems that every time I play this game, at least half the players involved are able to win within a turn of each other, or at least able to complete their sixth objective within a turn of one another. One person will finish their sixth objective, and then at least two other people at the table will be like, oh, I was going to finish my objective on my turn and finish the game, happen to be a little bit slow.
I mean, as far as the objectives go, for one thing, as long as you're doing some of the bottom actions, like, those all lead to an objective. And then also, like, I mean, most of those take similar amounts of turns, roughly similar, when you take into account what resources they cost. And I mean, like, combat, like we said, is easy to do. Secret objectives, easy to do. Sorry, I was looking at the board.
Yeah. We have it kind of set aside in case Matthew ever gets kind of quiet. That's how you know he's looking at the board.
Yeah, and so I just think that a lot of the objectives overlap between players. And when you take into account the time that the remaining ones have to take, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, and it can kind of be explosive, like, when you can complete an objective.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because you can have three mechs for a long time in the game, do something else, and then eventually come back and defeat your fourth mech. I like how the number of objectives that you've completed, you put, like, little star tokens on a part of the board that notates which objectives you've done, and all players can see that, which is kind of fun. You can see if someone is in the lead, but it can be deceptively so, because, you know, if you have seven of your eight workers, it's not hard just to get that eighth worker. You might as well have that objective completed. Same thing if you've got all the mechs made and you have enough iron to complete a final mech, you just haven't done it yet, or something like that. So I like the kind of game, or the kind of dynamic between players that exists, because you can see who has completed what objectives. And also what resources and where their pieces are on the tracker and stuff each player has.
Yeah, so I want to talk a bit about popularity.
Oh, can I just say one more thing, though, about the objectives? And that's that sometimes, this is a cool thing that happens in the game, there's these revelatory objectives where you'll be playing for a while. You'll just be kind of doing a little bit of each action. You have certain objectives in mind, but then you'll find yourself in a situation where you're only one or two turns away from completing objective that you weren't even planning on completing, which has happened to me every time I've played the game. I'll say, like, oh, I'm actually kind of close to doing this objective. You know, I should just do that real quick because I have, you know, the ability to do so in just a couple turns, and then I'll get back to my other strategies. And that's kind of an interesting, I like that point in a game where it's like, oh, I actually am a little bit further on something that I wasn't even planning on. That's cool. Kind of appears to you. So you wanted to talk about popularity?
Yeah. So popularity does two really cool things that helps sort of prevent snowballing and helps catch up. So for one, we mentioned the tiers of popularity. And that's pretty important because it doesn't necessarily mean amount of stuff you have equals winning. Because, I mean, like, you get points for, you know, the number of objectives you complete and all that, and the number of spaces you control. But if you have only the first tier of popularity, even if you have a lot of those, someone who only has a few, you know, less than you, but has more popularity can win pretty easily. So that adds an interesting sort of, like, balance to that, that you're not necessarily in the red if you don't get all of your objectives, or if you're spread pretty close together, you're not spread thin. So that's pretty cool. Also, in terms of combat, it feels like a lot of times in games like this that have the option of combat, but, like, combat lets you control territory or something, it's almost necessary to build war power, with the idea that you lose popularity by fighting, and even when you spread thin your workers, you'll lose popularity if you go towards somebody who does that. Then it sort of adds this, like, it's like it helps both players have reasons not to do something. Like, the player who doesn't build as much war power or is weaker, they might be able to, you know, spread thin or defend based on trying to keep the opponent from not wanting to fight necessarily. And the people who have more war power might need to be aware of the popularity loss. Mm-hmm. It makes it it makes claiming territory fair by not punishing the players that don't claim a lot of territory, or like not punishing players, or it doesn't reward players too much for claiming territory from other people, since you just get your workers back at the home base. You're not really losing too much most of the time unless you have resources.
Mm-hmm.
So popularity is a really good sort of keeping everybody close in terms of winning.
Mm-hmm. It also is the least interconnected of the resources and objectives in the game. You can only spend popularity at encounters. Each encounter has three options that are usually gain a small amount of resources, pay money to gain a little bit more resources, or pay popularity to get a lot of resources. Other than the option of paying popularity in certain encounters, it does nothing except earn you the most points per thing at the end of the game. So that's kind of interesting. It's a little more of maybe like a newbie trap in some cases, where people won't prioritize popularity at really early stages of the game. And then if the game ends too quickly, then they'll just be left with too few points per thing that they've done, where they won't be able to win from that kind of a position. And it also, because you get so much from spending popularity from those encounters, like a player who's not so familiar with how important popularity is might be more willing to do so. And in the end, they might end up one or two popularity off from the next tier and the next large amount of points that they could have earned. And so popularity, it's not very connected with other things. You can also spend it to produce you've built four workers, which I typically hold off as long as I can to do that because of this reason as well, because I want to save my popularity. I like, you know, trying to reach the top of the popularity track, at least the third tier at some point in the game is pretty important to me, and then maintaining that position.
Yeah.
And it can't be taken away from you by other players unless, is there a mech ability that does so? I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think other players can take it away from you.
So, yeah. Another thing, we mentioned how popularity, you can have to pay it for workers.
Mm-hmm.
That's another good sort of catch-up / rubber band mechanic, is that if you, like, a lot of times games that have strict worker to resource production, like Agricola, for example, is one we covered, getting all your workers is such a big deal that, mm-hmm. Half the game is just get to that as fast as possible. Scythe prevents that from being as necessary by having these worker taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another good way that it uses these things simply to, you know, help players that are further behind in one way catch up, and players that are ahead in one way have to take their time a little more.
Mm-hmm.
It's an evening out sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's see. Is there anything else we'd like to say about Scythe? The artwork looks good.
I have a couple things.
Okay.
So, artwork-wise...
Yeah.
So, actually, backing up a second. Each faction, we mentioned how they all have their thing. This is something I personally like. It's not a necessity for games, but I like it when strategy games like this have different, like, factions or characters that have their unique niches. Scythe does this pretty interestingly by giving the player something they can do from the very start of the game that guides them in a way, and also by having like the different starting islands provide different resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the factions start things on very specific spaces on the board.
Yeah.
Depending on which faction you have determines where you start on the board and what resources you'll have access to because of that. At the beginning of the game.
So, like, for example, the red faction is very good at getting to the factory as soon as possible because it starts on an island with workers and iron as its two adjacent territories to its home base.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means you can really quickly, you know, move your workers to the worker space, get workers, get your first mech from the iron space, and then get the ability to move from the worker space to the factory.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that's interesting about that is they sort of help tell you how that works through the graphic design. For example, the colors, I think, make a difference. So, like, the combat card-focused faction has the yellow color.
Mm-hmm.
And the war-slash-mountain faction has black.
Slash-tunnel faction?
Yeah.
Right.
The water walking that can go across the river and then kind of helps move across general areas is mm-hmm. blue.
Mm-hmm.
The encounter one is white, which I guess is sort of makes sense.
Not really.
Yeah, that's fair. But then there's also...
It would have been green if it were right, that's fair. To match the encounter card color.
I think red either makes way. Sense because it's like worker spaces are red. Factory's kind of purplish red.
Mm-hmm.
But also, each character has an animal partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that also affects it. So like the black one has a wolf.
Mm-hmm. It was black fur.
Black fur and white eyes. It's looking to chomp on some people.
Yeah, it wants to attack.
That makes sense from that perspective. The blue one has, like, this bison, which...
It's a water buffalo.
It's a water buffalo. And it's sort of a big, hulking thing that isn't necessarily known for being aggressive.
It's not really a water buffalo, but you could interpret it that way.
Yeah.
It's still kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. The yellow one also has, like, a bird of prey,
mm-hmm.
which I think makes sense for, like, the combat-focused one.
Mm-hmm.
The white one has a bear, which is like a very wild thing.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of see in media, like people having partner bears and they go on adventures. Brave,
right.
Brother bear, all that. So yeah. So that's a cool bit about how they tell you how to sort of play your faction through mm-hmm. aesthetics.
And I like the fact that it doesn't dictate your entire strategy for the whole game.
Oh, yeah. There's room to breathe.
Yeah. If anything, it only affects like one or two of the objectives that you're going to be focusing on. The remaining four is totally up to you in a game.
And honestly, unless you're playing with a bunch of people who are really skilled at the game and know a lot, it might not be that important at all to focus on those things.
Right.
You can just sort of do whatever.
It's at least a little bit of fun to do it at least once. Like, especially with the encounter person who picks multiple options for their encounter rather than just one, they pick two. That's always a fun opportunity. Honestly, I really like the encounters in this game.
Yeah.
Because they all have a little bit of narrative to them. They have a name, and the options are preceded with, like you see a farmer in a field. Do you slaughter his cows, or do you give him some food, or do you recruit him for your army? I really like the encounters.
Yeah. And one last thing that I want to bring up is that sort of like how we mentioned in our Food Chain Magnate episode, how that game teaches players to think ahead multiple turns. Scythe does this really well by not letting you take the same action in a row.
Exactly.
And since... because you kind of automatically think, like... You kind of automatically think, like, okay, I can't take the same action next turn, so I'm going to have to do something else. How can I make the most of that? And then... When do I want to come back to this action?
Right.
So...
Because, I mean, your actions only do a little bit each turn. So it is important to figure out what the order of actions you need to do are and how many times you need to perform each action is in order to do something else important.
And when you first get, like, the first time you play the game, when you first get that enlistment, that mech, that upgrade, mm-hmm. it does make enough of a difference that you want to do it again as soon as possible. Because... what you've done up till then feels so weak comparison.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And honestly, not every game needs to teach the player to think multiple turns in advance, but a strategy game like this that's this heavy,
mm-hmm.
it definitely helps.
Yeah.
That they kind of make you do that.
Yeah, I do really like that aspect. Because you can't do the same thing twice.
And in a way...
What order are you going to do things in?
With
then?
The red faction being the only one that can do the same action twice... Since that's unique, if the player realizes that, they might be like, how can I use that to my advantage since nobody else is?
Right.
So that's sort of, by having that be the catch to that faction, it still lets you think in advance, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's just about everything we love about Scythe. There's even more we haven't mentioned.
There's a whole solo mode we haven't played.
Oh, right,
with
yes.
With like an... They call it an automa deck, like that one JRPG.
Automata?
Yeah. Well, something like that. Yeah. But this is something that Stonemaier has been doing, I think, starting with Scythe.
Mm-hmm.
Just this idea of having sort of an CPU player AI-driven thing.
Right. It's a dense game. It's got a lot of really great artwork. The pieces are really great, and the gameplay.
We have one expansion for it we didn't even cover that adds two factions, and there's a third one, I think it might be out already,
mm-hmm.
that adds, like, airships.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's another interesting part of the mechanical punk.
Yeah, diesel punk, I think, is the common term.
So that is our episode on Scythe.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you for listening.
Excited
to cover more of these fun games that we love.
Our greatest hits, as I like to call them, and as Matthew does not like to call them for some weird reason.
Let's agree to disagree, and also agree that if you'd like to hear more about us or hear more from us, feel free to follow us on social media.
Mm-hmm. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at BG Bros Cast.
Yep, you can find our
website.
Yeah, our website at www.bgbcast.com.
That is correct. You can search through our episodes based on the games that we mention. You can see all of our different posts. All of our episodes are all found there. You can also find all our episodes on our friend's website, entertainthegeeky.com. Our friends Chris and Roger host their podcast there, Entertain the Geeky, as well as Nerd News. They talk about all things nerd, geeky, geek culture, what have you. You can find that there. In addition, you can find our very own one-page role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. It's $5 right now, but you can get it for free with promo code Geeky.
G-E-E-K-Y.
Mm-hmm.
Use that at checkout.
Use that at checkout. Get a free copy of Merle's Truck Stop in Maine, perfect for the merry month of May. You can follow us on social media, as we said, and on their website and our website for information regarding our Kickstarter, which is coming soon. Hopefully in June, for the kickstart of our gaming company, EG Games, as well as our very first card game,
Conniving Cooks,
mm-hmm.
a bluffing and deduction card game for 2 to 6 players, in which players play as cooks at a 5-star restaurant, trying to trip up all the other players while serving the correct dishes to the correct guests.
Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't mention games that are like Scythe.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, but, you know, is there anything like Scythe? Well, yeah, there's plenty of.
Yeah.
We mentioned 4X games.
I haven't played a whole lot. I know there's a bunch of popular ones like Eclipse.
Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game.
Sure, yeah.
Twilight Imperium is another popular one.
Another game that's sort of like it is Concordia,
mm-hmm.
which has a similar resource map, dude moving
right.
aspect,
but there's less of isn't there less of a player combat war,
yeah, it's a financial war,
right? And then we played a light version of a 4X game recently called Tiny Epic Kingdoms.
Oh yeah, which is very very light,
very light, tiny. Yeah, the board is constructed of cards in front of each player that are the size of, you know, playing cards, and you move very small pieces between them to collect resources and wage war and stuff like that.
But that's a fun, affordable option if you want a similar experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is our episode. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you for listening.
Stay tuned to next week when we talk about... Yes?
I do want to bring up some news that I heard about.
Okay.
So, of course, we've mentioned that we are going to be at Geek Way to the West, the board game convention here in St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
which is May 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th. However, on the 20th, there is word of a Entertain the Geeky game day at the Miniature Market location in St. Louis. So we'll get more information about that as we learn it. We'll keep that up on Twitter and probably on Facebook as well.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we'll be there.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Check it out.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you for listening.